This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Remember that $2 billion J.P. Morgan trading loss? Well, now you can make it $4.4 billion.
And the latest numbers on growth in China, it's still way, way faster than us, but to many, it's not good enough. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Friday the 13th of July. Coming up, we're going to talk about that J.P. Morgan trading loss. It's the big story in business this morning. Also, Italy is the new hotbed of trouble in Europe as the country gets its credit rating downgraded by two notches today.
And Comic-Con is going on in San Diego. Should we ever get tired of the same old Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, Green Lantern? Are there new heroes waiting in the wings? Well, I wanted to know, so we called on down to San Diego to find out. It's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We'll start with J.P. Morgan Chase. The bank has released its quarterly earnings report this morning, and the big number to report is $4.4 billion. That's the new estimate for the size of J.P. Morgan's loss from risky trading bets. The previous estimate was $2 billion.
Marketplace's Heidi Moore has been tracking this story this morning, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Heidi, how could they have been so wrong about the size of this big trading loss?
Well, let's take a look back at how this loss started. It was so huge, over $100 billion that they put at risk, that it was called the London Whale. It was just so enormous.
There was a London trader involved.
Exactly, who is now going to lose his job, as well as several other people. So J.P. Morgan had to do a lot of work to unwrap the more complicated trades that that trader put on in order to hide the size of his loss. So it's taken them over 3 months to really figure it out.
And the new estimate, as we said, is $4.4 billion, but I gather it could even go higher than that.
Right. It could be up to $6 billion, up to $5.7 billion, or even more when all is said and done, because J.P. Morgan also revealed that this loss goes back to the beginning of the year, which we didn't know before.
And it's possible that some people besides the London trader could lose their jobs.
That's right. In fact, they will, and they're losing their bonuses. This is probably the biggest clawback of Wall Street bonuses that we've seen in a scandal ever. They're going to lose 2 years of bonuses, no severance, and they're losing their jobs.
Now, we also got an earnings report this morning from Wells Fargo. And when you look at these two big banks, how is the banking sector doing right now, huge trading losses aside?
Right, exactly. It's not all traders on trading floors. There's a real economy at work here, and Wells Fargo is a good insight into that. Their earnings are doing well, in fact, $4.4 billion, coincidentally, and they're lending to businesses, they're lending to people, and they're seeing mortgage applications. So that's a bit of optimism there, and J.P. Morgan's lending more as well.
Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, we just heard about Wells Fargo's earnings. Wells Fargo put those out just after the Justice Department announced a $175 million settlement with the bank. Wells Fargo allegedly discriminated against tens of thousands of African-American and Hispanic borrowers between 2004 and 2009. From Washington, here's Marketplace's David Gura.
Wells Fargo says it decided to settle to avoid a long court battle. The bank is denying allegations it offered white borrowers better terms.
That's probably due to the fact that the loans in question were made by mortgage brokers.
Guy Sakala is with Inside Mortgage Finance. Mortgage brokers are independent parties who sold Wells Fargo loans. So the bank has come to this conclusion.
If it's too hard to police mortgage brokers, we're not going to deal with mortgage brokers going forward.
Sakala says choosing to cut ties with independent brokers is not going to hurt Wells Fargo's bottom line. It's the largest lender in the U.S.
They're in a position now where they can pick and choose a little bit about what business they want to do.
But it will be a big blow to independent brokers. In the first quarter of this year, Wells Fargo accounted for 20% of their business. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, now to Europe, where the focus has been on Spain for a while, but today Italy stole the spotlight after its credit rating was downgraded by the rating agency Moody's to just two levels above junk status. For more, let's bring in Marketplace's European correspondent, Stephen Beard. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
So do we need to be worried about Italy now, Stephen?
Well, this is pretty serious. I mean, Italy is the big one. It's the Eurozone's third largest economy. It has more than $2 trillion worth of government debt. It's too big to bail with the existing bailout fund. But it's too big to fail as well. If it defaulted, it really could rip the euro apart. Daniel Gross is with the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels, and he says this Moody's downgrade is a damaging blow to confidence.
We should be very concerned. If everybody thinks Italy is going down the drain, the Italian economy will deteriorate, and in the end it might go down the drain.
And some Italians are even looking to the former Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, for salvation.
Silvio Berlusconi, I thought he was pretty much done when it came to leadership in Europe.
Yes, but they failed to drive a stake through his heart, Jeremy. He may have been ridiculed out of office. He's actually still on trial, accused of paying for sex with Ruby the Heart Stealer, a 17-year-old. But Silvio, according to reports, would like to make a political comeback. He'd like to be prime minister again, and he would apparently promise to pull Italy out of the eurozone.
Well, while we've got you here, Stephen, I want to ask you about another big economy in the eurozone, France, where the new socialist government is really trying to set an example with austerity measures.
Yes, indeed. And some observers say this shows you how serious things are in the eurozone when French socialists start taking their snouts out of the trough. They do have a reputation for living fairly high off the hog. But the new president is positively slumming it, taking the train to Brussels rather than the presidential jet. Ministerial salaries have been cut by 30%. And, quelle horreur, champagne is out at official receptions. It's been replaced by a cheaper white wine called Muscadet. They must be drinking that through gritted teeth.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Jeremy.
As we said, today the rating agency Moody's downgraded Italy's credit rating. The move immediately sent borrowing costs up for Italy, naturally, and sent the euro currency down against the dollar. It's hovering at a two-year low of about $1.22, which means it might be time to take that trip to Europe that you've been putting off. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Decades ago, summer in Western Europe used to be easily doable for middle-class Americans. But in recent years, the strong common currency jacked up the price, putting Paris and Rome out of reach for many. Beth Jenkins at McCabe World Travel says her clients went elsewhere.
Eastern Europe, South America, places where our currency is stronger.
Now that the euro is weaker,
we've seen people interested in Europe because they realize that their dollar can go farther.
Exchange rates like these have Jenkins ready to take off.
Well, it certainly makes me excited. It makes me want to go.
It's like a 13% discount from last summer. Frommers.com editorial director David Lytle says that savings can really enhance your trip.
You can jump to another city, you can splurge on a meal, or you can buy some luxury goods.
Or upgrade from hostel to hotel. So Europe's woes may save you from sharing a bathroom with a backpacker reeking of patchouli. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Well, while we're talking Europe, Jeff, in Greece, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find someone who thinks the economic situation is good.
Yeah, I think so.
But the Pew Research Center did manage to do it. They polled Greeks, and 2% said the country has a good economic situation. Just 2%. 2% also think the country is headed in the right direction. I don't know, maybe they're on some sunny island down in the sea, and things look pretty good from where they sit. But that survey from Pew also checked in with people in other countries, and it turns out that the highest satisfaction in terms of national economy went to China, where 83% of people said things were good.
Well, on that note, overnight last night, we got these new economic growth numbers, GDP growth numbers from China, and they have certainly lived up to the hype. By which I mean they were as bad as everybody expected. China's GDP growth slowed in the latest quarter to 7.6%. That's the slowest in 3 years. BBC correspondent Martin Patience is in Beijing to talk the numbers through with us. Hello, Martin.
Good morning.
So what gets the blame, if you had to pick a couple of factors, for the slowdown?
Well, I think there's two real reasons. China is the biggest exporter in the world. Therefore, we're seeing a downturn, the economic turmoil in Europe. We're seeing slow growth in America. These are the two biggest markets for Chinese exporters. And if consumers in Europe and America aren't buying Chinese goods, then the knock-on effect is felt here, of course. And then I think a second point, the Chinese authorities are trying to stimulate domestic consumption. That's basically getting the Chinese consumer to buy more Chinese-made products. And why do they want to do that? Well, they want to be less reliant on exports for economic growth.
So it's kind of funny. As you say, China relies on us for growth. The last few years, of course, much of the world has really leaned on China to be the growth engine for the rest of the planet. Does this most recent quarter's growth change that?
Well, no, that's what's interesting. Although you have to look at what countries rely on China for growth. Countries like America want to see more British and American companies selling goods to China in order to boost growth back home. Certainly in the short term, I think it'll be other countries. It's the countries involved in commodities that could be hit if this slowdown continues.
Let's talk about the number itself. This is true everywhere, but especially in China, I've seen people describe the GDP figures as coming out of a black box. Is there any sense that even these numbers we're talking about today might be too rosy?
Well, it's often difficult to get a clear answer, particularly when it comes to Chinese data. And when you speak to economists in the country, many of them are split on this issue. Certainly some economists are saying that actually they think the slowdown is more serious than the Chinese authorities are letting on. Some of the figures I've heard are about 6.5%.
The BBC's Martin Patience in Beijing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Just a little more context. China's slow quarter, 7.6%, that's still fast by most any other standard. As a comparison, first quarter growth in the U.S. economy was 1.9%.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
A few days ago, Jeff, I mentioned that some recent findings have come out that say that Americans have way too much stuff, that a large number of garages in this country can't even fit cars because they are so filled with other junk. A team of researchers from the UCLA Center on the Everyday Lives of Families followed middle-class American families for years to find out all kinds of data on the material goods we manage to accumulate.
Well, here to talk with us today about those very findings for the Midday Extra is Jean Arnold. She's a professor of anthropology at UCLA and one of the authors of that study. Hi, Jean.
Good morning.
So how did you go about finding this data for the study?
Well, you know, we have access to all this information from marketers and economists about what Americans buy, but we have no idea what they do with all this stuff once it crosses the thresholds of their homes. What do people keep? What do they display? Are they hoarding? Are they using their stuff? So we adopted several methods to get a real unvarnished, unflinching look at life behind the scenes of the American middle class. We went into homes, we videotaped, we photographed. We've got pretty much everything that people are gathering up. For example, America has 3.1% of the world's children, but consumes 40% of the world's toys. Mm. And our book, Life at Home, is showing the visual aftermath of all that purchasing.
One of the other interesting things that you mentioned in the study is that people don't go out into their own backyards.
It was very sobering to discover this, the degree to which Angelenos, who have access to, you know, great weather and should be living the California dream that harkens back to the 50s of outdoor living in the backyards. And we found that 50 of the 64 parents in our study spent no time whatsoever enjoying leisure in their backyard spaces during the time we were filming.
Well, what's wrong with us, Professor?
Well, you know, conspicuous consumption continues to be the modern America's favorite contact sport, but it really goes all the way back to the 1890s when department stores were springing up, displaying all kinds of wonderful, glittering things. So we've got a long tradition of stuff piling out of store doors and ending up behind our own closed doors.
Are we all hoarders? I mean, maybe not in the sense that they make television reality shows about us, but would you classify Americans by and large that way?
No, I don't think we want to call it hoarding, but we're very good at buying our identities. Our things are our biographers, I think is one way of putting it. And we're better than other countries at buying our history, our family histories, if you will, more so than countries like Italy. We had sister centers from our UCLA study in Sweden and in Italy that were looking at the material world in those countries. And they're far less likely to have all kinds of modern stuff and much more likely to have heirlooms and smaller numbers of objects that have personal meaning. Maybe it's because we're a younger country and our families tend to split up and move across the country and carry fewer things, and we fill our homes with newer things.
Gene Arnold, professor of anthropology at UCLA.
Thank you.
So you like superhero movies? Jeremy, are you into that?
Occasionally I'll check out a superhero movie. I love the Batman movies.
Yeah, I actually love all of them. I really do. But even my patience has limits. We've now got the fourth Spider-Man movie in 10 years. That just came out. And next week, it's the seventh Batman movie of the modern era. I had to go back and count. I wondered, how long can we keep doing this, recycling these characters?
Same old characters.
Yeah, I know. You got to run out at some point. Well, the Comic-Con convention just kicked off in San Diego. And if there's any place where we could get an inside line on the heroes of tomorrow, those up-and-comers, I would think this would be the place, right? So Jeff Boucher writes the blog Hero Complex for the LA Times, and he is with us from Comic-Con in San Diego. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing?
Spider-Man, Batman, the X-Men, these are comic characters from decades ago, right? Movie audiences, I would think, they have to get tired of these retreads eventually, right?
Well, you would think, although there's something to be said for mythology that sticks. Superman's been reinvented in every decade by that decade's Hollywood and interpreted by that decade's audience.
But we have to run out of characters eventually, I would think.
Yes, we do. Although, every once in a while a new one does break through. Hellboy, for instance, certainly not one of the classic comic book characters, but made it to the screen. And then there's movies that are based on comic books, but people don't really know it, like a Road to Perdition or History of Violence or Ghost World.
So I want your predictions now as you look ahead 20 years. Who do you think might be the new Spider-Man and Batman?
That's an interesting question. It'll probably come, from the world of anime. That's the area of comic book world that is doing best as far as a publishing endeavor. And then, you'll see Superman again. You have to remember, too, is that for Hollywood, these aren't just about selling movie tickets and popcorn. These things are selling toys, merchandise, video games. That's where the really big money is, and that's why every year you're going to see that familiar red S.
So it sounds like even if there is some exhaustion with Superman, Batman, et cetera, there's a deep well that the industry can pull from.
The thing about these heroes is they always show up in the nick of time, so don't worry. There'll be another one.
Thanks. Jeff Boucher writes the Hero Complex blog on comic books and pop culture for the LA Times. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Well, according to the calendar that I use, Jeff, today is Friday the 13th.
I must use the same calendar as you.
Well, so far all is well, despite that. But if you believe in the ancient Mayan calendar, doomsday is in the air because the world is supposed to end on December 21st. Huh. And wouldn't you know it, some businesses are already trying to profit from the apocalypse, as Carl Baker reports.
Marketing doomsday is moving from the fringe to the mainstream. This year, the National Geographic Channel launched Doomsday Preppers, a series that featured Americans preparing for society to unravel.
It was our highest rated series ever.
David Lyle is chief executive of the National Geographic Channel. He's not taking any chances. He's bringing the series back for a second season, even before the year is out.
I went to this the other day and...
Jason Charles swings open the door to his Harlem storage unit. Inside, he's stockpiled enough food and water to last a full year. Charles is a New York firefighter, doomsday prepper, and aspiring entrepreneur who sells $240 bug-out bags. They're backpacks filled with provisions so that survivors can escape disaster zones. But so far, business is slow.
Now, should a disaster hit close to home, which sucks to say this, but my business is going to shoot up.
That's what's happening elsewhere. Costco says sales of its emergency products jumped 80% in 2011 and are still rising. For $3,500, you can buy a pallet stacked with a year's worth of dried meats, vegetables, and grains. Just add water, but that'll cost extra. I'm Carl Baker for Marketplace.
So speaking of doomsday, Jeremy, I found this item this morning poking around. Engineers from France just yesterday displayed this thing that they call kind of a hard drive, and it's designed to last 10 million years. That's what they hope. It cost them $30,000 to make it, so you won't be picking this up at your local Circuit City anytime. Well, Circuit City doesn't exist anymore, so you certainly won't be picking it up there. You won't be picking up at your local Office Max, let's say. And it's made of sapphire, which sounds beautiful and awesome. The data inside is engraved on platinum. So that's all cool until you notice why they invented this thing. They needed a way to tell people millions of years from now what they need to know about our nuclear waste.
Well, that'll be a nice surprise for them, Jeff.
Uh-huh.
And if post-apocalyptic landscapes are your kind of thing, I've got a real estate deal for you.
All right.
It is a hotel in the Australian outback, built back in 1934. Concrete floors, tin walls, and a beer fridge.
Glamorous.
All for the low, low price of $760,000. Now, sounds maybe too good to be true,
Not
Jeff,
really, but all right.
But there
Tell
is
me
one,
more.
one little catch that you need to know about. The place is overrun by freshwater crocodiles and pythons, although the owner says, don't worry, the snakes aren't really poisonous.
Well, yeah, you pay extra for that kind of thing. Of course, I can see why it costs what it does. Well, in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.